The Katra Podcast Conversations for the Curious Essential Knowledge, Simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of a Katra AI. Welcome. Today, we are attempting something, pretty monumental. We aren't just diving into one book.
No.
We are diving into a whole library, really. A 2,500-year-old curriculum for, I guess, human happiness, liberation. We're opening up the Tripitaka.
The Three Baskets.
Oh.
That's the famous name.
Yeah.
And when you say library, you really mean it. The Tripitaka is the vast canonical scripture of Theravada Buddhism.
Right.
It's not just, you know, random stories. It's this meticulously organized system. Philosophy, psychology, ethics. It's all in there.
The scope is just staggering. But the goal, it seems, is incredibly focused, singular even.
It is.
What was the central mission for Siddhartha Gautama, the Buddha, whose teachings make up this entire collection?
Well, the mission fundamentally was to solve the core problem of existence, which is, you know, suffering, dukkha. So the Tripitaka is basically the complete roadmap.
Yeah.
It outlines the theory and the practice, the Noble Eightfold Path, that's the practical side.
Right.
And it's all designed to move someone from that state of conditioned dissatisfaction.
Yeah. That feeling we all know.
Right. Towards complete liberation, nirvana.
What's really fascinating, I think, is why this ancient text matters now to you listening today.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we're swimming in self-help books, stress reduction apps, new ethical frameworks.
Oh, absolutely.
But this material, it feels like the original source code, doesn't it?
It really does. It's this time-tested, incredibly detailed methodology for cultivating wisdom, for cultivating compassion.
Which is so relevant for, well, modern mental well-being, navigating tricky ethical stuff.
Exactly. It sets out an actionable path. It's not just a philosophy to sort of, you know, think about casually. It's something to do.
Okay, let's talk about who wrote it. Because it's not like a novel, right? With one author.
Yeah.
The attribution is various authors, which feels a bit off.
It is a bit misleading, yeah. That term doesn't mean competing writers or anything like that.
Right.
It refers to the collective body, the Sangha, the monastic community.
Oh, okay.
There were the custodians, you know,
compiling,
verifying the teachings over centuries. But the ultimate source, of course, is the Buddha himself, Siddhartha Gautama, around the 5th century BCE.
So after the Buddha passed away, his enlightened disciples gathered the first Buddhist council to basically lock down the teachings, right?
Yeah.
To prevent distortion, because it was all oral tradition back then.
Exactly. And that reliance on memory is just incredible. That's the foundational authority.
Wow.
And two figures really stand out there. First, there's Ananda. He was the Buddha's personal attendant, famous for having this absolutely flawless memory. So when it came time to recite the discourses, the philosophical stuff, the suttas, he was the main guy.
Okay.
And his recitations always began with that really authoritative phrase, "Evam mi suttam."
Thus have I heard.
Precisely. Thus have I heard.
That single phrase, it just anchors the whole thing, doesn't it? It tells you straight away, this isn't just my opinion. This isn't guesswork.
No.
This is testimony from someone who was there, a trusted witness.
Exactly. And the second key figure was Upali. He was the expert on the rules, the institutional side, the ethical structure.
Got it.
So he recited the monastic rules, which became the Vinayapitaka. Their authority comes from this communal system of checking, of verification at these councils.
Right.
Preserving this sacred oral tradition through meticulous chanting, all backed up by their own direct meditative insight. They weren't inventors. They were preservers and clarifiers.
That communal verification, it adds this huge layer of rigor. You just don't see that with many ancient texts.
Absolutely. Yeah. So let's explore the structure, the three baskets idea, the Tripitaka. It's actually really helpful for getting your head around the organization.
It sounds like a blueprint where you need different materials passed along for different parts of the job.
Yeah, that's a good way to think about it.
So what do these three baskets represent in terms of the path to liberation?
They represent three interconnected aspects. You've got doctrine, discipline, and detailed analysis. And they were preserved in these divisions, but they're really meant to be practiced together.
Okay. So the first basket, the one maybe most people encounter first, the Sutta-Pitaka, basket of discourses.
Right. This is the heart of it, really. It contains thousands of sermons, dialogues, verses, things the Buddha actually said.
So this is where you find the stories, the parables.
Exactly. And the core philosophical principles, the Four Noble Truths, the Eightfold Path, non-self, karma. It's all laid out here. It's primarily concerned with Dhamma, the truth, the way things are.
Okay, then we move to the Vinayapitaka, the basket of discipline. This sounds more practical, institutional.
Correct. This is the ethical and institutional backbone. It's the detailed code of conduct for monks and nuns.
How detailed are we talking?
Oh, very. Like, yeah. 227 rules for monks, 311 for nuns, plus all the procedural rules for the community. It's all about establishing a supportive, harmonious environment for practice. So the mind isn't getting pulled away by ethical mess-ups or community drama.
It's the grounding in ethical conduct, right? Sila.
Precisely, sila.
And finally, the basket that seems to have a reputation for being daunting, the Abhidhammapitaka, higher doctrine.
It definitely is the most intellectually complex, yeah. It takes the concepts you find in the suttas,
right,
and just dissects them, subjects them to this systematic, abstract, almost mathematical analysis.
Okay.
People often call it Buddhist psychology or metaphysics. The whole goal is to develop this really profound wisdom, punya, by breaking down every single moment of experience into its ultimate fundamental parts.
So if I'm understanding this right, the Suttapitaka explains what the path is and why you should walk it.
Mm-hmm.
The Vinaya explains how to live it practically, ethically, within a community.
Right.
And the Abhidhamma explains the deep, like, microscopic understanding that comes from really practicing the path diligently.
That's a great summary. It's totally comprehensive, top to bottom.
Okay, let's dig a bit deeper then. Starting with that practical bedrock, the Vinayapitaka. This isn't abstract stuff, is it? This is, like you said, where the rubber meets the road.
Exactly. And what I find really fascinating about it is how pragmatic it is. It's not like a set of divine commandments handed down.
No.
No. The Sutta Vipanga part, which lists all the monastic rules, the Paramokkha, it gives these detailed origin stories for every single rule.
Origin stories. You mean like...
Yeah. So the rule isn't just don't steal. It's more like, okay, this specific incident happened. Monk X took property Y. It caused distress in the community. People complained. Therefore, to prevent that kind of suffering again, this rule is established.
Ah, I see. So the Buddha was responding to actual problems, case by case.
Exactly. It's a living response to the challenges of communal living, focused entirely on keeping the environment stable and supportive for practice.
Makes sense.
And the other key part, the Khandaka, that's basically the Sangha's operational manual. How to ordain a new monk, how to run assemblies, even the rules for the annual rainy season retreat. It's all laid out. Very practical. Okay, let's shift gears now to the Suttapitaka, the core teachings. You mentioned five major collections, the Nikayas.
That's right, five big collections.
Let's start with the Digha Nikaya, the long discourses. These sound like the big picture stuff.
They often are, yeah.
Yeah.
They cover broad, sweeping themes, major ethical discussions, sometimes dialogues with kings or other philosophers of the time.
Any famous examples?
Oh, definitely. The most moving one for many people is the Mahaparinibbana Sutta.
What's that about?
It gives this really detailed, emotional account of the Buddha's final days, his last instructions to his followers, his passing into nirvana. It's powerful.
Wow. Okay. Then we hit the core, you said. The Majjhima Nikaya, the middle-length discourses. Why are these considered so central?
Because they offer these really detailed, varied, and in-depth explanations of the most fundamental concepts.
Such as?
Well, for instance, the detailed guide to meditation practice, the Satipatthana Sutta, the discourse on the foundations of mindfulness that's in here.
Ah, okay, a key one. Absolutely. And these discourses often present the teachings through lively dialogues. You see the Buddha adapting his message for different people, skeptical kings, simple villagers, other ascetics.
So it shows the teaching method, too.
Very much so.
And we shouldn't overlook the Khudaka Nikaya, the collection of minor texts, right? Even though minor sounds, well, minor.
Hugely misleading name, honestly, because this is where you find some of the most famous, most beloved, most widely quoted Buddhist texts.
Like what?
Like the Dhammapada. That's a collection of 423 short, poetic verses on ethics, the mind. Many people feel it perfectly sums up the entire teaching.
All right, I've definitely heard quotes from that.
Yeah, it's very accessible. And you also get the Jataka tales in this collection. These are wonderful stories about the Buddha's past lives.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, they illustrate virtues like patience, compassion, self-sacrifice. They're very engaging, great for teaching core values.
Okay, all right. Brace yourselves, everyone, because now we're ascending to the Abhidhammapitaka. You called it the GPS satellite imagery earlier.
Huh. Yeah, that's a good way to put it. The Abhidhamma's main goal is to strip away conventional language, Things like me, you, anger, chair.
Okay.
And instead, deconstruct existence into its absolute, ultimate, impersonal building blocks. These are called dhammas.
It's like a microscopic analysis of reality, of consciousness.
Exactly. So if someone feels fear, right, the suttas might talk about the situation, the thoughts that led to the fear.
Makes sense.
But the abhidhamma, it's cataloging the precise moment-by-moment mental factors like aversion, restlessness, the specific material phenomena in the body, the type of consciousness arising, all the impersonal components that constitute that instant of fear.
Wow. That's incredibly detailed.
It is. The first book, the Dhammasangani, basically does that cataloging, enumerating all the ultimate realities.
Okay.
But the real heavyweight champion in here is the Vipassana, the Book of Conditional Relations.
Sounds intense.
It is. It's this monumental work that exhaustively analyzes the 24 different ways that things can be causally related to each other. 24 modes of conditionality governing everything.
24.
Yeah. It's so complex, the tradition says even the Buddha himself had to spend 7 days contemplating it after his enlightenment.
That really gives you a sense of the depth, doesn't it?
It does. And the whole point of this incredibly detailed microscopic work isn't just, you know, intellectual gymnastics.
Right. There has to be a practical point.
The practical point is cultivating that penetrating wisdom, panya, an insight that sees right through the illusion of a permanent, solid self.
Oh.
Because that illusion of self is the root cause of clinging and therefore suffering.
So when you realize deeply that the self is just this constantly changing flow of interconnected conditions.
Exactly. It loses its power. The basis for clinging just dissolves.
Okay. So we've journeyed through this vast library. Let's try to boil it down. What are the central takeaways, the key themes that run through all three baskets?
Right, the big messages. Well, you absolutely have to start with the foundation, the Four Noble Truths.
The diagnosis and the cure, you called it.
Precisely. And that's theme one. They state, suffering, dukkha, exists. Crucially, it has a cause, craving, and ignorance. And therefore, suffering can be stopped. There's a path out.
And the link to daily life there is.
It's incredibly empowering, recognizing that your stress, your anxiety, your dissatisfaction, it's conditioned. It's not just random bad luck. It's not permanent. It arises due to causes and conditions.
Which means you can change those conditions.
Exactly. It puts the agency right back in your hands. You can do something about it.
Okay. Theme two builds on that diagnosis. The three marks of existence. Impermanence, anicca. Suffering, dukkha. And non-self, anatta.
Yes. This is so essential for just dealing with life.
Yeah.
With change, with loss.
How so?
Well, we suffer because we cling, right? We grab onto things, our youth, our health, a job, a relationship, an idea, as if they're permanent and solid.
Yeah, we do.
But this teaching gives you a framework. It says, look closely. Everything changes. Everything is impermanent. Anicca. Clinging to the impermanent inevitably leads to suffering. Dukkha.
And the non-self part.
Anatta. That helps you see there's no fixed, unchanging me at the center of it all to protect or defend. It lifts that heavy burden of identifying so strongly with things that are bound to change. It's about practical acceptance, really.
Right. Okay. Theme three. This one gets misunderstood a lot, I think. Karma.
Oh, definitely. Karma, or kama in Pali, simply means intentional action. That's the key. Intentional.
So it's not fate or cosmic justice from somewhere else.
Not at all. It's the natural law of cause and effect. Driven by the quality of your intention. Good intentions lead toward happiness. Harmful intentions lead toward suffering. Simple as that, really.
So how is that empowering?
Because it means you're in the driver's seat. If you understand that every conscious intention you have plants a seed for a future result, you're motivated to be mindful, to choose ethical, conscious actions in your work, your relationships, everything. It's about personal, immediate responsibility.
Got it. And theme four brings us right back to the hands-on practice, which seems woven through everything. Mindfulness, sati, and compassion, metta.
Yes, these are the direct tools for training the mind. Mindfulness, sati, gives you concrete methods like watching the breath, noticing sensations to develop emotional intelligence, to observe difficult thoughts and feelings without getting swept away, non-judgmentally.
Which is huge for stress.
Huge.
Yeah.
And compassion, karuna, and loving kindness, metta, are like the essential emotional purifiers. They actively counteract hatred, ill will, aversion. And you need that clear, kind heart for any deep wisdom to really take root.
Okay. The Tripitaka is also known for packing all this complex stuff into some incredibly memorable, practical lines, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. Especially in texts like the Dhammapada.
Let's look at a few key quotes or ideas. I'll start with maybe the most famous one about the mind, from the Dhammapada. Quote 1, mind precedes all mental states. Mind is their chief. They are all mind wrought. And it goes on to say, if you act with a pure mind, happiness follows like a shadow.
Yes. That line immediately tells you where the real work happens. It's internal.
Right.
Your external situation matters, sure, but ultimately the quality of your experience, your happiness, is determined by the quality of your mind. It's a call for radical inner transformation, isn't it?
It really is. Yeah. Okay. Quote 2, another one from the Dhammapada, which feels like a super concise summary of the whole path. To avoid all evil, to cultivate good, and to cleanse one's mind, this is the teaching of the Buddhas.
It's perfect. Yeah. So simple, so direct. It hits the three core trainings: ethical conduct, avoid evil, mental cultivation, cultivate good, and wisdom, cleanse the mind. No ambiguity there about what's required.
Love that clarity. Quote 3 is fascinating. It's often called the Buddha's Charter of Free Inquiry, from the Kalama Sutta, basically saying, do not believe in anything simply because you have heard it, but after observation and analysis, then accept it and live up to it. That's a paraphrase, of course.
Yes. That one is revolutionary, especially for its time. It's an explicit rejection of blind faith.
Totally.
It encourages critical thinking, personal investigation. The teachings aren't presented as dogma you just accept. They're presented as something you have to test out, experience, and verify for yourself, like a science experiment for your own mind.
And quote 4, a really powerful message, apparently from the Buddha's final instructions. Be islands unto yourselves, be your own refuge. Let the Dhamma, the teaching, be your island, the Dhamma your refuge.
Yes. From the Mahaparinibbana Sutta we mentioned, such a deeply moving instruction, it really emphasizes spiritual self-reliance.
That's not.
Yeah, ultimately you have to rely on your own sustained practice, your own cultivated insight. Not looking for some external savior or depending on someone else to do it for you.
Powerful stuff. Okay, so how does this ancient wisdom actually work in your life right now? Let's talk real life applications, starting with mental health.
Okay, well, the instruction on Anapanasati mindfulness of breathing is a prime example. It's a direct, repeatable technique.
How does it help?
By simply anchoring your attention, gently but firmly, on the physical sensation of your breath, non-judgmentally. You interrupt the mind's habit of getting lost in worry loops or regret spirals.
You break the cycle.
Exactly. It's a mechanism for calming the nervous system right here, right now.
Yeah.
It's proven effective for stress, for anxiety reduction, and it comes straight out of the Sutta.
We can also use these principles for making decisions, right? Especially ethical ones.
Absolutely. Mm. Think about the five precepts: refraining from killing, stealing, sexual misconduct, lying, and intoxicants. They're more than just rules. They act as a profound ethical filter.
How so in, say, a modern workplace?
Well, it directly informs the concept of right livelihood. Is your work causing harm? Is it ethical? And right speech, how are you communicating in emails and meetings? Are you being truthful, constructive, kind?
Mm.
The precepts push you beyond just following the law. They guide you toward making conscious choices that aim for long-term well-being for yourself and others.
And what about relationships? Conflict is inevitable. How can concepts like non-self, anatta, and loving kindness, metta, help there?
Anatta is like the antidote to taking things personally.
Okay.
If a colleague snaps at you or a loved one seems angry, the insight of non-self helps you see their behavior not as coming from some fixed malicious person, but as a result of constantly changing conditions.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe they're stressed, hungry, tired, acting out old patterns.
Right. It's not necessarily about you.
Exactly. It fosters objectivity, empathy. It reduces your own reactive suffering because you're not building a big story around it. You replace personalization with understanding the conditions. And meta practice actively cultivates the goodwill to respond constructively.
And finally, for dealing with complex problems, whether it's at work or in society.
The principle of dependent origination is key there. That's the teaching on interconnectedness.
How does that apply?
It explains that everything arises based on causes and conditions. Nothing exists in isolation. So if you're tackling a complex problem in business, social issues, whatever, this principle encourages you to look beyond the surface symptoms.
Go deeper.
Yeah. Address the root causes, often related back to ignorance, craving, aversion, rather than just slapping band-aids on the symptoms like conflict or scarcity. It pushes you towards more holistic, systemic, and ultimately more effective solutions.
You know, going through all this deep dive, it leaves me feeling surprisingly optimistic.
How so?
Well, the Tripitaka really presents itself as a kind of verifiable science of the mind. It doesn't demand blind faith. It offers this detailed path, asserting that suffering isn't just random awfulness, it's conditioned. And because it's conditioned, it can be understood, worked with, and ultimately overcome entirely through human effort and cultivated insight.
Yeah.
That feels hopeful.
I agree. For me, the final synthesis, the ultimate message distilled from this immense collection, is interdependence.
Ah, yes.
Our individual well-being and the harmony of the collective, they're inseparable. You can't really have one without the other in the long run.
Right.
And the Tripitaka provides this complete, incredibly detailed, time-tested guide for shifting our perspective, moving from a default worldview based on separation, fear, and scarcity,
which causes so many problems.
Exactly. Towards one fundamentally based on connection, wisdom, and active compassion.
So since the whole path relies on personal testing, personal verification, maybe we can leave our listeners with a thought to chew on.
Good idea.
What small observable principle from the Tripitaka, maybe impermanence, maybe noticing intention, maybe just 5 minutes of mindfulness, what will you test out and verify in your own life this week?
See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Ekatra Foundation.